Welcome to The Drummer's Pathway, the podcast about music, life, and the creative process.
Hello, I'm Michael Scott, and welcome to The Drummer's Pathway podcast. This episode features my conversation with renowned drummer and educator, Jim Riley. Originally growing up in Boston, Jim went on to study at the University of North Texas, where he received his degree in music education. In 1997, he moved to Nashville and established himself as one of the most respected and versatile drummers there. For 20 years, Jim was the drummer and band leader for the multi-platinum group Rascal Flatts, and has worked with many established artists throughout his career. He is currently an adjunct professor of drum set studies at Belmont University. Jim is internationally recognized as a clinician and educator, and in 2007, he established his Drum Dojo School, where he inspires and teaches students of all levels to develop their skills and passion for music. He is also the author of three books, including The Award-Winning Method, The Survival Guide for the Modern Drummer. In our conversation, we talk about why it's important to believe in your potential and not be afraid to face challenges. We also discuss the value of a well-rounded education and what the definition of success means to him. And now, my conversation with Jim Riley. I first had the pleasure to see you play back in 2018 at the Ralph Angelillo Drum Festival in Quebec City.
Yeah.
And at that time, I was extremely impressed with the clinic that you gave. But what impressed me the most was your professionalism, your positive attitude, your humble nature, and your true and genuine passion for education. So looking back, growing up in Boston, Massachusetts, and starting studying at around the age of 12, how did formal education first come into your life?
You know, I was in the fourth grade, and I really begged my parents to let me play percussion, and they said, absolutely not, you know, you're nuts, and, you know, we're not going to add that to the mix. And I asked them again in fifth grade, and they said no. And finally, sixth grade, they realized I wasn't going to stop asking. So they said yes. And I think that it probably had the opposite effect that they thought it would, in that it actually really kind of brought me together and galvanized me as a human, gave me a really good center to work around. So I started taking lessons. I remember my first teacher is a guy named Lenny Clayton. You know, I have no idea whatever happened to Lenny Clayton. And then there was this other guy, Mark something, that I took lessons with. I kind of got passed from one teacher to the next teacher pretty quickly. From there, I started taking lessons with Arthur Press from the Boston Symphony, and also got to take some lessons with Alan Dawson. So being in Massachusetts was a really good place to be in terms of educational opportunities for me. I was, my high school had a great jazz band. I was, you know, playing in the Greater Boston Youth Symphony, and I was playing in a rock band that was playing out in clubs in Boston. And so it was a pretty rich environment. But I mean, I kept up with my educational endeavors. I mean, I was taking lessons to play drums from age, you know, 12 to age 22. You know, I mean, I didn't stop. I mean, I was going all the way through college with lessons.
Now, looking with your experience with Arthur Press from the Boston Symphony, what are some of the things that he taught you?
I mean, he really opened up my mind to, you know, a lot of things. He got me playing marimba. He got me really interested in timpani. I credit him with really helping to mold me into a very well-rounded musician. Certain technique things as well. I think, you know, an early attention to detail that I may not have gotten, you know, somewhere else It was really great.
One of my earliest experiences as a student is that I had a chance to study with the principal percussionist of the Thunder Bay Symphony Orchestra, because I lived in Thunder Bay for a while. And what I got from him, same sort of thing, was exposure to playing timpani, to marimba, to xylophone. So it taught me melodic reading as opposed to just drum set applications. And it also changed my approach and my touch on the drums, and it changed how I viewed my role. One of the things that I really loved is that experience of playing in an orchestra where you're part of the big picture. Even though the parts in front of you may be simplistic on the page, really being able to understand how important that role is something that I found affected me through other stages of my career as well, too. And I found that experience to be invaluable.
Well, yeah. I mean, in all seriousness, I think we've seen, like, there's a little video going around of a guy sitting there, and he ends up standing up and playing one flam. And to me, everything I thought was, I actually had a real negative reaction to it. I was like, I didn't feel like it was a very good flam. I felt like his placement on the drum wasn't very good. And, you know, all of that stuff comes from, you know, when you elevate your expectations of what these things are going to be like. And I think going to North Texas, you know, further elevated my expectations of what, you know, high quality meant to me. And it's something that, you know, it's something that stays with you, you know, quality of sound, clarity of purpose. I mean, those to me are really important, you know, core, you know, concepts that that I literally start with when I'm teaching new students.
Now, you grew up in Boston, Massachusetts, but you went to the University of North Texas. I'm just curious as to why you chose the University of North Texas over Berkeley in Boston.
That's a really, really good question. Obviously, I grew up in the shadow of Berkeley, and I've been over at Berkeley. I've done a little programs over there and over at the New England Conservatory and over at, you know, Boston College, and I was familiar with Boston as an urban environment to study, and certainly is a very popular one. There's a lot of colleges there. There were two things. My high school band director went to North Texas. So if I went there in the late 80s, he was there in the 60s. And he played trombone, was played in the jazz bands, and he was the one who turned me on to North Texas. And then once I started doing some research about it, I figured out not only is it, you know, an amazing school, you know, for jazz, but it was also the premier school to study percussion in the United States. So it was kind of a no-brainer to me. The program there was phenomenal. I was under the direction of Bob Shatroma at that time. And he cranked out a lot of really fantastic drummers and educators, and I mean, that list is pretty extensive.
And at that time, you went there and got a degree in music education versus performance. Why did you choose music education as your path?
So I started as a jazz studies major, and what I realized was, it didn't matter what my major was, I was going to have the same opportunities to perform in these jazz bands regardless. So I just decided, you know, I was around a lot of people that were music ed majors. I said, you know, I love to teach. You know, even at that time, I'd already had some experience teaching even late in my high school years. And so I thought that that was just a much more practical path for me, because I figured, well, I'm going to be playing as much as I want to here anyways. I was still playing in the jazz bands, but ended up getting my degree in music education just to help fulfill my passion for teaching.
Now, looking at your experience at North Texas, what were some of the most challenging experiences that you had to overcome? And what were some of the biggest and most valuable lessons that you learned?
I think the first challenge was realizing that everybody there was that kid that was the really great kid from where they came from. I was used to being a pretty elite musician in Massachusetts. I mean, I wasn't without, you know, some failures, but I mean, I had, there were certain aspects of it, particularly in the classical side, where I was literally, you know, one of the top two or three players. And so I was used to that. And when I got there, my impression was, well, I know I'm a freshman, but I mean, I think they're going to see the value of what I do pretty straight away. And what I realized was every kid there was that kid. And there was 200 of us there, 200 percussion music majors. And I went, oh, wow. And my first experience was that with that was the drum line. Now, I went to audition for the drum line. I felt I had a pretty good handle on rudimental drumming as a high school player. You know, I'd played some pretty interesting repertoire as a high school kid. And I said, yeah, I'm going to be able to walk in there. And who knows, maybe I will make the snare line. I was a mile away. I was 10 miles away from making that snare line. I was there for about 3 minutes. And they politely told me to go over the hill over where the tenor drums were. I saw the tenor drummers. They looked like five aliens that didn't speak any kind of language I was going to speak. So I just walked on by them and ended up in a collection area over by the bass drums with about 25 other kids. And I got cut from the bass drum line. Now, I did something that I don't know if I recommend and I don't know if I approve, but it's what I did. I went up to the guys that cut me. I said, I think you made a mistake. I said, I think I've got what it takes to play on this bass drum line, and I would like for you to give me another opportunity. And they said, okay, come back tomorrow. They had 10 guys total trying to go for five spots, and I ended up landing one of the five spots. So I went to bat for myself, and that was a pretty nice success. And playing in that drum line, I mean, it definitely elevated my understanding of rudimental drumming, and then being involved in that drum line. You know, there were people that taught me how to play the marching tenor drums, the quads, as some people call them, quints. And I played those drums at North Texas on scholarship, and then marched in Drum Corps International as well. And so those experiences really made me look at my attention to detail in a whole different way. I mean, you want to talk about like taking a micrometer out to everything that you're doing. And, you know, you think that something's good and then you realize it's not even close. And that's a lot the way the drumline stuff was. I think that some people could get completely ate up with the drumline stuff, but I think I got just enough of it that it was of great benefit to me. And yet I wasn't someone who was hanging their hat on that. I was involved in lots of other things. I was playing in the jazz bands. I was playing in the percussion ensembles. I was playing in the symphony orchestra. I was playing in the wind ensemble. I was playing in the Javanese gamelan ensemble and the African ensemble and any other ensemble that I could play in. So, you know, that experience was really great for me at North Texas. And I think one of the best things was just being around a lot of highly motivated, highly talented, you know, future titans of education and industry and drumming, you know, that I remember thinking, how can I expect to do well in this world when I can't even be the best drummer in this little tiny town of Dent, Texas? And then I realized later that it was filled with some of the best drummers on the planet. We were just all happened to be there at the same time. So pretty interesting.
Was it a fairly competitive environment, or was there a good community of support amongst the drummers that were there?
Yes, it was competitive, and there was a very great camaraderie. You know, to make one of the jazz bands, you had to go into an audition in a drum set room to just play. And of the 50 people that would go in there and audition for that, you know, maybe 25 got to go in and audition with the band. And of those, you know, 15 players got to play in a jazz band. And that's two to a band, you know, going down from a certain spot after the first couple of bands. But it was pretty insanely competitive and daunting at first. But then once you got to look at the pitch of the mountain, you went, okay, I just have to start climbing, you know, and started taking lessons with Ed Soap there and just listening to my peers and listening to Ed and practicing and just, you know, climbing the mountain and seeing how far I could get with it.
He's got a reputation for being an exceptionally difficult teacher at times. So what were your experience studying with Ed Soap like?
He was an exceptionally difficult teacher. Now, he really was, you know, very hard on you. You know, most times I left my lessons feeling like I couldn't believe how bad I was. But when I kind of look back at the experience, I learned a lot about musicality from Ed. Of course, Ed taught me the Mohler system, which is really crucial in my playing, just having a fluidity to my playing. Mm-hmm. That's something that I really learned from Ed. I learned a lot about just listening to the duration of the notes that the band's playing and making sure that I'm matching those durations. And I had a really great experience with him. And I think we have an interesting relationship to this day, because I'm probably not the guy that Ed thought he was going to be asked about for the next 25 years after he taught. But that's the way that it happened. You know, there was probably somebody that he thought was maybe more of his type of player in terms of being a more pure jazz player. I might have been a better student than I was. But I was, you know, one of the ones that was really successful. And so he got asked about me a lot, you know. And I get asked about him. And like I said, I have a huge amount of respect for him. And I think it was a really great full circle moment for me getting to do a clinic there. I think it was 2015 or 16. And Ed was in attendance and Dr. Shatroma was in attendance, both of which had retired at that point, Ed just the year before. And it was a really incredible full circle moment for me. And then getting to, you know, go out, eat dinner with those guys after that and just kind of talk shop in that way. It was pretty neat.
After North Texas is when you made the move to Nashville. Why did you choose Nashville over, say, Los Angeles, New York, or a lot of the other big circuit places?
Yeah, well, I mean, I've been in Boston. I mean, Boston is a great music town. I lived in Dallas, or I lived in, you know, the Dallas area going to North Texas. So Dallas is a very vibrant music scene. It was great. I also lived in Kansas City for 2 years before moving to Nashville. But I felt like they were mostly, there was no clear path to the next level that I could see from those places. I couldn't see like a ladder. Like if I go over there and climb that ladder, I can get up to the next level. I didn't see any of that in those cities. And I wanted to go someplace where there was at least an opportunity to get on the next level. I mean, Nashville has a local level like every other place does, but there's also, you know, this kind of national and international level there that just didn't exist in other places and was, you know, really hard to get to in other places. And my thought process real quick was this. I looked at my skill set objectively. I said, I'm not passionate enough or good enough as a jazz player to just play jazz in New York. That's not really my passion. And so as a result, I would not do well in that environment. If I went to New York, I would definitely, giving my love for music, my ability to play lots of different styles, my ability to play other instruments, including marimba and timpani, that leans right towards me going into Broadway. And there's obviously, those are amazing jobs, and there's some really great people playing those jobs. It just wasn't the pure vision of what I had imagined for my career. So I decided to just skip that and go, I'm going to leave that over there and let me look at some other options. I looked at, you know, Los Angeles, and it seemed very spread out. I knew that it was expensive. It looked like there was a lot of opportunities to make music in movies, but I couldn't really catch a pulse of like a music business. Like, how do you even get involved with trying to play with artists? On the other hand, in Nashville is someplace you can like literally see the music business happening. You can see the pulse happening. You can put your finger right on it. Anybody can. It's right there. They tell you where it is. It's right there. And if you go to Music Row, you will see the music business. I felt like there was a lot of opportunity there. And even before that, I said, you know what? While I'm struggling, I think I could afford to live in Nashville more than I could afford to live in either one of those other two places. So I think the thing that compelled me most, and I've told this story a little bit before, but I'll tell you. So in the early 90s, you know, I mean, I love all the grunge music, you know, Soundgarden and Rage Against the Machine and Nirvana and, you know, all of that stuff. I really love it. But I also acknowledge that that music was off-putting for a lot of people. So there was an alternative to the alternative that rose up in the early 90s. And that was country music. And that's when Garth Brooks became the biggest artist on the planet. And so I was exposed, like everybody else in America certainly was, to Garth Brooks and Alan Jackson, Reba McEntire and the Judds and all of these people that were coming up. And I was like, wow, the musicianship is incredibly impressive on these records. So I went to a drum clinic. We had everybody you could imagine came there and did a drum clinic. You name them, they were there. But Larry London did a drum clinic, and Larry was the number one drummer in Nashville. He was the king, and he came and did a clinic at North Texas. And I said, that's a guy I got to meet. So clinics started at 12. I showed up at 10, walked in, just me and Larry. I introduced myself. He's setting up his drums. I helped him. We talked about Nashville. We talked about country music and the limited experience that I had playing country. And he was just tremendous to me. He gave me his phone number. He said, when you come to town, you know, give me a call. I'll take you to a session, which is a story I've heard from a lot of other people that he took, you know, to sessions. He really was key in giving Eddie Bayers his start as a Nashville session player. Eddie Bayers was a keyboard player on Larry London drum sessions. And he sat down at Larry's drums and he went, man, you sound great. He's like, I'm just messing around. He says, no, you're not. He says, I'm going to start, you know, having people call you. And he did. And that's why Eddie Bayers has, you know, for 25 years was the king. But anyway, so I got done with this encounter with Larry, and then other people showed up, and then the clinic started. And long story short, Larry had some sort of medical episode, and he fell ill that day and never recovered and died a couple of months later. So I was the last person to have like a really lengthy conversation with Larry. And that conversation really sealed the deal for me to move from North Texas to Nashville. So in 97, I moved to Nashville and started my journey there.
So what were your first experiences like when you first got there?
Well, I mean, a lot of people were saying, well, you really missed it, you know, in the early 90s, that the stuff I was just talking about. You know, Nashville was just cranking, and they were like, you really missed it, you know, and I'm like, oh, okay, cool. But you know what? There was some clubs that I could play down on Lower Broadway. They didn't pay very well. And I mean, the first gig I got called for got canceled because somebody got shot in the club, you know, survive. But I eventually just started playing a bunch of little gigs there. And the 2 years before moving to Nashville, a little side note, I'd moved to Kansas City to make a record with a friend and then play in his band. But then that wasn't really a full-time gig. So I started playing at this country bar and playing all of this, you know, really older music from, you know, the 40s to the 80s. And I learned a lot of country music at that time. I credit the time I spent there to be just as important as the time that I spent at North Texas in terms of my professional development. So when I got to Nashville, I looked like this long-haired rocker guy, which I was, but I clearly knew the music in a way that they were like, wow, this guy, he knows this music. And so I was getting hired to just play little local gigs. And then at that time, the atmosphere was very like pro jam, like guitar players walking in with their guitars around their shoulders. And there was more of that really friendly but incredibly competitive thing where guitar players were just going in there and just showing out, and, you know, and it was really interesting. And so I fit right into that environment and made a lot of friends and was playing gigs. And I was able to catch some breaks pretty early on in my career there. My first summer in town, I sort of mopped up on some road artist gigs that other people had. At that time, there were more artist gigs than there were, like, you know, musicians in my mind, or really great musicians. So I played two different artist gigs that first summer where people had bailed on that because they were on to the next thing. But then the next year, I was playing a $40, you know, 6 to 10 shift at Legends. And the bass player for that job, he had just gotten the gig with Mark Chestnut. And long story short, they needed a drummer too. And he recommended me. And so I went out and played with Mark. So a year after coming to Nashville, I was in New York City playing on the first season of The View, you know, playing on national TV with a national artist. I was like, holy cow, man, this is what I was dreaming about. I played with Mark Chestnut for 2 years, which was an incredible experience. And I was moonlighting a little bit with a young artist named Hank Williams III, who was Hank Jr.'s son. And my buddies had gotten a record deal, some guys I was playing in the clubs with, and they asked me if I'd be interested in working with them. I said, I'd really be interested in hearing your project to see, you know, I mean, honestly, I was thinking, I want to hear if this is something I do want to get involved with. And I mean, I heard the first 3 seconds and I was sold. I was like, before, you know, I heard the first 3 seconds and I was like, I'm in. Whatever you guys are doing, I'm doing. And I quit Mark, and Mark was very gracious about it, but he and everyone else thought I was absolutely nuts for leaving this, you know, really big established artist to go play with my buddies. But I was young enough that I felt like I could make a dumb move if I needed to, and I would be able to recover. But I felt like it was a smart move for me. I felt like it was the right move for me. And it ended up being, you know, one of the, you know, the best decisions I made in my career. I played with Rascal Flatts for 20 years from the beginning of their career to where they're at now, which is on hiatus. And now I'm playing with the lead singer, Gary. Just played with them last night.
And when you look at your experience with Rascal Flatts, which was 20 years of your life, you started out originally in the drummer role, but you eventually took on the role of being the music director for that band.
Yeah. So that was interesting because I was the last guy hired. The longer-winded story of it is that the guys told me they were going to call me for this gig, and then they didn't. They called somebody else, and he was a good friend of theirs, and they had a lot of really good reasons for calling. Mostly emotional reasons for calling him. So they did one gig. It was a private gig. It was an industry gig. it did not go well, and everyone knew it. So they had a meeting. They said, well, what are we doing here? And they said, well, we should have called Jim Riley. And they're like, well, who's Jim Riley? So they called me, and I started doing that. So I was the last guy hired. There was amazing sidemen on that job. Only two, because you have to remember that Rascal Flatts is a lead singer and a bass player singer and a guitar player singer. So they don't need a lot to fill that out. Mm-hmm. So we filled it out with, at that time, a fiddle player, a keyboard player, and myself on drums. The other guys were older. The other guys were more experienced. The fiddle player had just come off a plane with Garth Brooks, who had then retired and now has since is back at it. Mm-hmm. And now Jimmy is back at it with him. But at that time, Jimmy was playing with us. He was amazing. He was a really great mentor. And then there was a keyboard player that was also older than I was, named Bo Cooper. And Bo Cooper is, you know, I mean, he's gone on to play with, he was playing with Peter Cetera. He was playing with David Foster. He plays in David Foster's band. You know, I mean, he's done a ton of things like that. So these were heavy duty guys that I was playing in the band with. And then, by the way, you know, the guys in Rascal Flatts are really, really smart, smart musicians. And so I came in as the drummer and did my job. And I think I, you know, did a good job of that, was really passionate about it. And about a year into the job, I got a call from their day-to-day manager. You usually have a manager and then you have someone who deals with them on a day-to-day basis. I got a call from their day-to-day manager and he said, hey, the guys don't want to make any changes in personnel, but they would feel more comfortable if you would take over as the band leader, musical director for the show. They just feel like you have a better vision for what they want. And so they've already talked to Bo, who's happy to step aside and to just play keyboards. And it was never a discussion, and it was never a weirdness. There was nothing weird about it. It was the weirdest thing that there was nothing weird about it, but there wasn't. So I took over that. And I think that in retrospect ended up being a tremendous decision for them, simply because those older guys, they were at different points in their career. They ended up quitting to do other things. But I was there with them because I was their contemporary. So I really believed in this thing with them. And so I was able to, for the next 19 years, to curate the band for them and to deal. I think they knew if there was anything that needed to be dealt with on a musical level, that I was going to deal with it. If it was the beginning of the tour, you know, and they said, hey, write a set list and then we'll start there. And they knew I was going to put a lot of thought into it. And then I'd bring it in and we bang it around. And every once in a while, they'd go, yeah, let's start there. That's really great. Or, you know, we want you to write like a 1-minute intro to the show and we want it to be cinematic. Okay. Or we want you to do, I was just talking about this with Gary last night. They asked me, they said, we want you to do an a cappella version of Happy, the Pharrell song, and then some Rascal Flatts song that's not currently in the show. And keep in mind, at that point, there was a guy named Tim Akers in the band who's since passed away, God rest his soul. He was a wonderful musician and a brilliant arranger. But he wasn't the musical director on that gig. They asked me, and I came up with something pretty great on that. So I think that, you know, they knew that I had a really great vision for what they wanted. I was passionate about it. And they've always trusted me with that. And I've always been appreciative of that. I think just like when I was a kid, what my high school band director realized, he said, the more responsibility he gave me, the better I behaved. So I think I felt like when I'm in the leadership position over there, I mean, with great power comes great responsibility. And I took that responsibility and still do take it seriously. And, you know, so I've carried that over playing with Gary on his solo dates. And who knows, maybe we'll do some with Rascal Flatts in the future. It's been over 4 years now since we've played together. So who knows? I hope maybe it'll come around again.
In the musical director role, was there any task that was assigned to you that took you way out of your comfort zone?
Thankfully, not. I'm a little bit more comfortable outside of my comfort zone than other people would be. You know, when I got asked to write a 1 minute intro to the show, I had never done that before, you know, so buckled down and put something together and wasn't afraid to ask, you know, for help to get some people to collaborate and work on something. When they've asked me to do choir arrangements, you know, I did choir arrangements. I once did a marching band arrangement for Life is a Highway so that a marching band could play with us on stage. I'm willing to take on things that I've never done before. I've got a meeting on Tuesday with a film producer that's like, maybe you want me to do some music for a film. I've never done music for a film in that capacity. I've had songs that were in films, but I've never written for a film before. And I would love that opportunity. I just love to make music. And I'll figure out the other stuff. I mean, I think one of the most complicated things with the musical director spot from the percussion standpoint is just how physically busy I am. I've got my drums and my four limbs, and I'm singing on this microphone, and I'm directing on this microphone, and I've got a computer over here, and I'm listening to cues and starting the show so that the light show and the video production will all be in sync. And that was a learning curve from the beginning, but fortunately it was really raw. Rascal Flatts, in a great way, was really raw in the beginning, and then it got more refined as we were trying to get to that higher level. Like when we toured with some of these bigger acts, we saw what beautifully slick productions they had, and we learned from them, and we're like, man, we really saw how it was done when we opened up for Toby Keith and Kenny Chesney and Brooks and Dunn. And so we learned a lot being around those headliners, and when we got a chance to do it, by that time I was ready. I had the right learning curve, and felt really fortunate.
After Rascal Flatts kind of went on hiatus, you actually became a professor of drum set studies at Belmont University.
Yeah.
As a teacher going into those situations, how does your sort of lifetime of experience affect the lessons that you teach to the students in that environment?
You know, it was really great timing to get that call from Belmont. I was definitely... I just found out that the Rascal Flatts thing was, you know, going away. And at that time, you know, 2020, none of us knew anything about what was going to be happening in the future, whether there would be any music business at all ever again. So I got a call to see if I was interested in the Belmont job. And they really just wanted to check my, you know, see if I was interested. And once I said I was interested, you know, I actually went through a pretty extensive interview process and was up against probably about 10 other people for that job. But I think, you know, I think they really enjoyed the fact that I had a lot of real life experience, but I also had some academic credits that they felt were pretty compelling. You know, the books that I had written and the clinics that I had done, you know, and it was obvious that I was really committed to being an educator. So the only reason I was really super interested in that job was because they weren't looking for me to teach their curriculum. They were looking for me to impart my knowledge and my experience to to the students. What I was thinking about was the fact that Chester Thompson taught there for 20 years, that Zorro taught there for about 4 or 5 years. They had people, they had a history of hiring people that were not traditional mainstream educators and making sure that their students, you know, were getting that real life perspective. So I wanted to use my own materials. They were fine with that. And, you know, that's something that I've been honing over the last 4 years, is what is my message to my students. And the biggest thing for me, and now after I'm finishing my fourth year right now, is I can't take any shortcuts with these kids on technique. I feel like if I do, there's going to be a roadblock later. So I'm starting them, you know, on making sure their fundamentals are really super sound, that they, you know, they know their rudiments, but not only that, that they have a really good flow to the way that they're playing. I'm talking about the, you know, the four stroke types, where we've got, you know, the full stroke and the downstroke and the tap stroke, and in my case, an upstroke is a molar, and how all of these combinations work. Talking about quality of sound very early with them. And the biggest thing that I find myself talking about, particularly this semester, is just making sure that whatever music we're playing, they understand the form. What is the form of this song? If you don't know what this song is, how are you going to play it? You know? And so we talk about that. And I have an opportunity, because of my experience, to talk about, probably more extensively than other professors would, about pop music, because I think that pop music is deceivingly difficult. Mm-hmm. I once was teaching a clinic at a U.S. military music education thing, and I had one of the soldiers walk up. I said, "Walk up to that whiteboard for me and draw me the best circle you can." So he drew me a circle. And I said, "Well, I think we all agree that's a circle, and it's a pretty good one. But if we look over here, we kind of see a flat spot. You know, we look where it kind of connects, it kind of overlaps. You know, it's a deceivingly difficult task, maybe even an impossible task, to draw a perfect circle." I said, "That's the way I think about pop music. I think people underestimate the task. And the problem is that jazz players feel like they're overqualified to play it. So they feel like, well, if I just dumb down my playing, I should be able to do this pop playing." I'm like, it's just as deep in the other direction. I wouldn't expect a pop player to be able to walk into a jazz gig any more than I expect a jazz player to walk into a pop gig. You have to do the work in every one of these genres individually if you want to be able to be great at all of them. And so I'm able to spend more time on popular music with them, because let's face it, if we look at the numbers, 99.1% of the music is being consumed on the planet right now is jazz. 1% is classical, and there's a whole nother 98% out there that is largely ignored in the education system. So for me, I feel like my opportunity to teach at Belmont is a chance to kind of dig into that and to make sure that I'm giving them a healthy dose of that, along with the other, you know, the world styles and the jazz playing, which I think are incredibly important as well.
One of the things that really impresses me about you as well is that you have written three exceptional books. I'm a fan of all three of them. First one was Song Charting Made Easy. The second one, which is probably the one that was most beneficial to me, was The Survival Guide for the Modern Drummer. And I also have Improvisational Tools for the Modern Drummer.
Yeah, that one's fairly new and it's harder to get a hold of, but it's a good one.
What I particularly liked about The Survival Guide is that it's written from the perspective of practical applications. And yeah, one of the things that you're going to find a lot of course material is, here's the fundamentals and here's all of the variations. And all of the time is spent on learning all the different variations, but not enough time is spent on the practical application of the thing that you learn. Yeah. Because there are situations where rock drummers have to play something that might have a Latin feel, and their knowledge of world styles is usually zero. So at that point, they're kind of going through and just trying to get through everything. And it doesn't mean you need to be an expert of this stuff, but you need to have some fundamentals of the tools that will get you through the job at a level that is acceptable for the job that you take. And I have found that that particular book for me is just a wealth of information of practical material. So I highly recommend that book. And I just want to thank you for writing that, because I've gotten a lot of benefit out of that one myself.
I appreciate that. You know, I had just been going back a ways, about 2006-07, Rascal Flatts was huge at that time, biggest act on the planet for part of that time. And so there was a cancellation at the Percussive Arts Society convention in America. And my name came up, and someone contacted me, see if I'd be interested. Because I had just been featured in Modern Drummer, so I think, you know, there was just a lot of things that were right at that time. They were like, what about that guy from that article? That would be great guy. So I did a clinic at PASIC, met the guys at Modern Drummer, told them I'd be interested in writing some articles for them. And they were like, well, do you have any ideas? I said, yeah, I got a couple straight away. I said, one of them, I'd like to talk about the Nashville number system. They're like, really? What is that? So I wrote a two-part article for them, and that was successful. And from that point, I contacted all three big three at that time, Alfred and Mel Bay and Hal Leonard. And only Hal Leonard reached back out to me about it, because they had actually produced one book on that subject several years before that. So they were interested. And so I did that book with them. And that was really great. I acknowledge that it's pretty well put together book, but I really wanted to do a drum set book. So I said, you know what? I need to do a drum set book. So I started thinking about what I wanted to do, and I decided I wanted to do a styles book. And I remember this was like right at the beginning of Facebook Messenger. One of my college buddies, who shall remain nameless, we were talking back and forth on Facebook Messenger, which was a new thing at the time. I was in Canada. It was winter, and I was stuck in a hotel room for 2 days. Sound familiar?
Yeah.
So I said, you know what? Today's the day I'm going to start writing, because, I mean, what the heck else am I going to do? So he's talking to me, and he says, well, what are you writing? I says, well, I've decided to write a styles book. I'm starting today. He says, oh, it's a terrible idea. He says, you know, you're like a professional. You're like a high level professional at this and this. You should just pick some things that you're really specialized at and just do that, you know, like country drumming. I said, yeah, I get that. I said, I just don't want to do anything that's, you know, that has a limited appeal. I said, honestly, my career has been all about the fact that I can do a variety of things, you know, dependent on, you know, what's been required of me, whether it's been, you know, jazz playing or rock playing or learning to play country, which I, you know, had to do. And I say had to because it's a skill that I had to acquire. I had to learn how to play that music. So I just felt like I wanted to write something that was more reflective of that experience. And I knew I couldn't write a book called Mastery of All Styles by Jim Riley, because I don't think I'm a master of all styles. I don't know that anybody is. And it would be much too big.
Yeah.
I said, so why don't I write a book that gives people just enough to survive if they get called upon to play some jazz? This is just enough language to survive. And then, you know, if you advance, then you can get better. You know, you can learn more. I don't want this to be the end of the learning. I want this book to be the beginning of the learning for all of this stuff. And so that's where I started. It took me 2 years to write the book. And then, unfortunately, I'm not done. And then it took me 3 years to write the book. It took me 2 years to record the music. And I say it took me 2 years. It was actually 2 years. If you're familiar with the book, so you know there's over 100. There's 124 play-alongs, and there's about over 100 unique ones. So that's like writing 12 solo albums of music. So, you know, think about that, and then you start to go, oh, okay. That's a lot of music. It took a long time. And there were two things that I wanted to make sure to do in that book. The first one was I wanted to expand what people's perception was of a Styles book. I felt like they were very four food groupy, where they'd be like, there's jazz and rock and Latin, you know, and it was like, that was kind of like everything. And I was like, you know what? What about country? What about metal? What about, you know, lesser talked about world styles like reggae,
yeah,
you know, that's really popular, that just doesn't get put in those same kinds of books. So that's what that was my first thing I wanted to do. And the second thing I wanted to do was I looked at the books that were out there and I said, you know, some of these tracks are great, some of these tracks are good, and some of these tracks are not good at all. And they're all done by the same five musicians inside of, you know, a week. Mm-hmm. I said, if I do this, I've got to use jazz players on the jazz stuff, metal players on the metal stuff, country players on the country stuff, blues players on the blues stuff, world style players on the world style stuff. And that's what I did. So I spent the time, which was 2 years, and I spent the money, which was enough to buy, I believe, you know, a pretty darn nice car. Not just an entry level one, a pretty nice one. And it was a lot of money. And it was a lot of time. And the reason is because I've joked with my wife, I don't know how to make fake music. I only know how to make real music. So everything to me, I was passionate about every note that I wrote and put together in the book. And I only knew how to make real music. So we made a lot of real music, which meant that as a composer, I was writing stuff that I didn't actually know how it was going to turn out on the drums. I only knew the basic beat, but then there's these little stops. It's like, did I have an intention? No, that's for you to figure out. That's what real music is all about. We have to deal with the real music aspects instead of just being a loop. And yes, it's just a place for you to practice that thing. I'm like, you got to play it in the context of music with a real form. And so that was my goal with it. And I was happy that it was received so incredibly well all around the world. And I'm very grateful for that.
Well, I know for me, I've often find myself in situations where I'm recording from home and I'll get sent tracks from people that are writing things for musicals or writing things for film stuff or a variety of different things. And sometimes what I will do when I get something that is a style that I'm not particularly fluent in, I actually take your book off the shelf and I will spend some time woodshedding the style before I actually attempt the recording for the chart that they set.
That's awesome, man.
Because I can read, so yes, I can read the chart that they send, but I want to be able to really get into the style a little bit more to make it better. So
I see you have both of the books, the drum set books there. I just, yeah, while I'm sitting here, this is pretty interesting. So I just wanted to show you something. This is the actual drum set from the cover. Yeah. So I just took it out to shoot a video the other day. And I just thought you'd be interested in seeing it. There it is.
That's pretty cool.
Yeah. My 1967 Ludwig White Marine Pearl.
Back in 2007, you started your own teaching studio, the Drum Dojo. So What was your motivation to start the studio? And what are the philosophies that you try and instill into your students?
I think there was a time period probably between 1997 and 2007, where I just didn't have as much time to dedicate to teaching. I mean, I say that I was starting to do clinics around 2006 is when the clinics thing went on. or was when that started. But I wasn't very active as an educator, just teaching a couple lessons here and there. And I think I saw my success and Rascal Flatts' success as an opportunity to use that platform to be able to get back to one of my, you know, big loves, which is teaching. I felt like I had a gift to play, and I felt like I had a gift to teach. And if I wasn't doing that, I kind of felt like I was doing the wrong thing in life. So I wanted to make sure to get back to it. My wife and I, you know, built this house, and, you know, it's built around being a drum studio. This is our, you know, this is the waiting room here. And, you know, there's, you know, the percussion studio on there. Again, it's a little topsy-turvy in the air because I just shot a video there the other day. But yeah, it's a great facility to have. And to be honest, the usage of it has just morphed over time. I initially was doing a lot of group lessons with kids, starting kids. And it's funny because I just saw Facebook posts from three of my students that I started in the sixth grade that are all going to study their master's next year. I'm going, wow, that's pretty crazy. You know, and one of them, I was just like, I told her, she's like this super smart young lady. And I'm like, listen, I understand you're super smart. I know you're super smart. You're a lot super smarter than me. You're like, you know, she's an academic whiz. I said, the problem is that people think when you're super smart that you have to do super smart people things. People expect that you're going to go into biochemistry or astrophysics. But you know what? The truth is, we need super smart people everywhere, yes, in everything. And so you are super smart, but you can take your super smart powers and use them to become the best music educator, you know, that you could be. I said, you're the kind of person that could go right through, get your bachelor's, get your master's, start teaching somewhere, and get your doctorate before, and it'd be easy for you. And I said, you know, you could be playing, which you love. You could be teaching, which I think you're going to love. And, you know, I said, I don't, you know, mean to be the person to tell you that, you know, that's what you should do. But fortunately, her twin sister was going into music. So it wasn't a hard conversation for her to have with her parents. And I didn't compel her in any way. We had the conversation. 6 months later, she came to me and she said, hey, I've decided to pursue music next year. I said, great. We better start working on your audition material. So it was pretty, pretty nice. And I've been keeping in touch with them. But, you know, honestly, the pandemic kind of put a beating on that part of the program. And I started to morph into some other things. So doing more privates now and doing more online stuff, and I'm, you know, swiveling to more online content as well. I think, you know, you mentioned my book, Improvisational Tools for the Modern Drummer. Mm-hmm. It's a book and it's really good. And there's a lot of really great content in there, but we are about 5 years past the prime of books. Thank God I put Survival Guide out when I did, because it was at the last gasp of the extreme relevance of drum books. I still think the drum books are relevant, and they're certainly relevant to me.
Me too.
But they are far less relevant than they once were. But here's the thing. The information that we have will always be relevant. It's just how are we imparting that information? And that's a little bit of the journey that I'm, you know, I, I'm getting ready to embark on now.
Well, the trend for educational material, as you said, is to go digital and away from the printed media. For me, I'm still a traditionalist, so I like the printed media. I like to come into my studio. I like to physically have the books on my shelf already primed to the page that I want to work on.
Listen, I have digital copies of all of my books. You know, I have a nice big iPad I'm talking to you on right now. I could easily, and I like some of the digital versions. I just like the paper copies much better.
Well, I find for me, sometimes the digital version is too much of a temptation to start going down the social media rabbit hole, whereas I have the printed version. It's not connected to the internet. I'm going to work on the task at hand. But I still see the value in terms of where the digital aspect and everything came in. As long as the information is out there and being consumed in the way that it's intended, then both of them have validity.
Yeah, absolutely. Fortunately, I think in the drum world is one place where books still have, you know, a large amount of relevance, but their relevance has dwindled. So I just, my concern is just wanting to reach as many people as I can. So to get back to the room, you know, about 2000, I think 17, I ended up really like investing in putting some recording stuff together. And since that time, you know, one of the things I also do down here at the studio is record my drum tracks. And I've done, you know, over 1,000 tracks in that time, which is a lot. And that's something that I'm still busy with. And I think that's been really great for me. Number one, because I can actually play on records. I'm to the point now where I can play on records here that are actually getting played out in the real world. I played on Gary's last single here. I played on a Canadian artist, a good friend of mine named Jason Blaine, who's a country artist. I played on his single that was, I was, I think, number 7 on the charts. It was the number 1 Canadian artist on the charts. Everyone ahead of him was an American artist. And that was something that, you know, I did here last year. So it's great to be able to play on real stuff in my own studio and to have the confidence that I can get great sounds. But also when I'm going to studios downtown or I get called to, you know, do live sessions, my confidence in my ability as a session player has just gone up exponentially just because now I'm literally doing it every day, you know? So when I go to, you know, do a session, like I just played on some stuff for Gary LaVox for, you know, his new record coming out, and played on that with a bunch of, you know, top session players and feel totally comfortable. Cause I'm like, this is what I do every day. Whether it's like bringing my snare drums and really feeling like I've got some great sounds dialed in. I played 3 songs for him. 2 of them were on a 6.5/14 snare that had a black dot, the coated CS black dot. Mm-hmm. And then a big, you know, leather damper on there and a couple of more moon gels on there. And it was tuned down super low. And that thing just sounds like $1,000,000. And I play that drum with no rim shot and it just goes and it sounds amazing. And then I picked up recently a 1923 nickel over brass 4x14 snare drum, and I played that on something and it sounded amazing as well. But for me, it's been important to have drums that I know do a certain thing. I walk in with that snare drum already doing that, rather than to have to search for the sound. I can already be 98% of the way there with certain drums, and I think that's something that's a little bit of a trick of the trade as a session drummer. The other one, this is a really small trick, but all of the highest level pros do it, and none of them told me. I had to find out for myself. They all tune their snare drum to a relevant pitch of the song that they're recording. Could be the root, could be the third, could be the fifth, could be the seventh in some cases. but they're all tuning them so that when the drum does have an overring, which sometimes is very pleasant, that overring is ringing harmoniously with the track. Little tip of the day.
That's a fantastic tip, because with the pandemic, that's when I first started trying to figure out the home recording thing. And it's definitely a learning
curve. Fortunately, I had a two or three year head start. Yeah,
it's definitely a learning curve. It's something that I'm always trying to improve upon, but it's something that I'm actually really enjoying that process. But what I most got out of that is the value of listening back to recording yourself, because it's the great humbler, and that's what's going to really teach you consistency and really help you with your time and really help you determine how to edit your playing, because you don't notice sometimes the subtleties that you put in out of your own experiences that sometimes don't translate well to the recording application. So it's something that I definitely recommend that everyone does, but you have to then be willing enough to listen back to the things that you do and not immediately judge everything as being not good, because everything, there's going to be some value in the stuff that you do. You just have to look at it and really learn from that experience.
Yeah, you hit the nail on the head. I mean, you know, and that really hasn't changed, you know, since the dawn of any kind of home recording. I mean, you know, I had my teachers in high school were like, record yourself on the little tape deck with the two fingers and you hit the record, you know. Mm-hmm. I mean, I was recording myself on tape decks back then, and now we just have better tape decks, much better tape decks. And so that's great, but you are right. I learned so much about my playing. I've learned some things I really didn't want to know.
Yep.
You know, and it's a very humbling experience. I learned in which situations I'm rushing the snare drum but not the kick drum, and I'm like, holy cow, man, you should be way better than this, you know. And you know, going, okay, well, let me give it another shot here, you know, where I'm just doing a better job with that snare drum. You realize when you're playing a four on the floor groove, you know, how hard it is to keep the snare and the kick and the hi-hat lined up on those twos and fours. But yeah, if you're willing to listen, and fortunately in my situation, it's professionally responsible. I have to, because I'm, you know, these are all going out to clients. So yes. I have to ask myself the same question I ask my students, which is, would you buy this performance? Literally, you know, because someone is going to buy this performance from me. Would you buy it? You know, even would you accept this on your record? Would you stream this? Would you listen to this and say that this makes sense? I want my students to be able to, you know, take the lead vocal, take the keyboards, the guitars, the bass all away, and if you're left with just the drums, I still want people to be able to hear the song structure in what I'm doing as a drummer. And if I'm doing that, then I'm laying to me a solid enough groundwork to build on. And I do a lot of work, a lot of it, where I'm the first one to go down. Mm-hmm. So I'll write a Nashville number system chart for myself, even though I'm not playing any chords. I will write the chart because for me, that's how I visualize. I'm hearing the song in my head because I'm singing and hearing that chord progression in my head when I'm looking at the chart. So a lot of times I will write a chart, I will put a click track on, I will play the whole song with nothing but the click track, and then we will build the song from there. That happens a lot. I've got a couple of clients that hire me because that's what we do. And I do a lot of that when I'm producing here at home. The only exception is if I'm working on a track that I feel like is really track driven, that's got like lots of loops and lots of synthesizers, I'll send it to my track guy first, get it right, and then I'll play to that. But if it's anything that's more organic than that, I will just start with a click track and drums and build from there.
When you look back at your career and the things that you've learned and look at where you are now, What's your definition of success?
Yeah, man. You had really great questions today, by the way. That's a very important question to me. And it's actually really simple and actually pretty easily attainable. You know, I've been lucky enough. I mean, if you're watching a video here, if you saw a picture of it, I've got, there's awards on the wall, and I've been on the cover of Modern Drummer, and I've played on Platinum Records and played on the Grammys and all of that stuff. And none of that really enters into my definition of success. For me, success is a really simple thing. I play music for a living, and I can support my family doing it. And really, anyone that I meet who is supporting themselves and or their family playing music, to me, is every bit as successful as myself or somebody 10 levels up ahead of me, like Ringo Starr or something. You know, I think if you are anyone who makes a living doing what they love, if you've somehow fooled the world into letting you do what you want to do for a living, then you are definitely a success in my book. And I meet, you know, drummers like that all the time. I was just up in Indianapolis and met a couple of guys that were like, oh my gosh, I walked into this place. There was a guy playing guitar and singing, and he got done. And he was also a drummer. So he went, oh my God, Jim Riley, what are you doing here? And we're just sitting there talking shop, man. And I mean, I'll do that with anybody all day, because I mean, at the end of the day, I just feel fortunate that I get to make music for a living. I love talking about it. I make my entire living either playing music, writing about music, producing music, teaching music. I feel really fortunate, and anyone who could do any version of that, to me, is a huge success.
One of the things that I remember about when I got to meet you at the Ralph Angelillo Festival back in 2018,
which was a fantastic festival.
It was an incredible experience all around. Unfortunately, we just lost Ralph, but yes. It was just one of the most amazing experiences, just being in that presence of all of these incredible musicians. But one of the things that really stood out to me is that after your clinic, you could find you upstairs in the showroom, basically giving little lessons and clinics in the Ludwig drum booth. And I remember going upstairs to trying to figure out who was playing. And you were basically saying, I usually give clinics that are an hour and a half to 2 hours long. I only got a 45 minute set, and I really just want to keep teaching. So you basically were just giving impromptu clinics and just demonstrating things. And I remember afterwards, once people kind of walked away, I spent a few minutes chatting with you about your song charting book, and I just really appreciated your passion and your kindness and your dedication as an educator. And that's something that still resonates with me today.
Well, I love it, man. I appreciate that. I love it. And any opportunity that I get to do that kind of stuff, I really, really look forward to. You know, we've gotten away from, there's not as much live clinic stuff as there once was. You know, I felt very fortunate to be in an era, you know, from, you know, 2006 to 2020, to do a lot of clinics over the years. And that one was certainly a highlight. You know, everyone had known about the Montreal Drum Festival, and that was an extension of that incredible festival there. You know, I got to do the London Drum Show. I did the last Modern Drummer Festival. You know, they used to do one at Columbus Pro Percussion called Columbus Drum Days. It was amazing. It was me, Alex Acuna, Carl and Raul, Todd Sirkeman, Greg Bissonette. And they're like, yeah, you're going on first. I'm like, yeah, of course I am. I didn't think I was going on here. I'm just happy to be here. I'm happy to be here, you know, with all these people, you know. I'm always humbled to be able to do it. And I understand I have a slightly different perspective, and that's why I'm there. And I'm always grateful for the opportunity. And I was certainly grateful to Ralph and everybody there. And I did there's a Nashville drum show, and I ended up doing a clinic there last year. I was actually subbing for my friend Rich Redmond, who had a last minute cancellation, so I went in there and did a clinic over there, and that was super fun.
Jim, it's been an absolute pleasure getting a chance to chat with you again, and I wish you all the best of success, and keep doing what you're doing, because I truly value you as an educator, and you're just inspiring the next generation. So I appreciate your time today.
Thank you so much, and thank you for reaching out, and I'm glad we were able to do this. I know you'd mentioned the eclipse. You know, I ended up having to postpone this appearance on the show a week, because last week I was at the solar eclipse, which was a really interesting experience. But thank you for being able to do this with me tonight, and I wish you success with this, and I hope to talk to you again another time.
Absolutely. All the best.
Thank you.
You've been listening to the Drummer's Pathway podcast. Please share and subscribe to get the word out, and let's keep the discussion going. Thanks for listening, and I'll see you next time.